Engaging conversation on the most urgent problem of our day and what you can do about it.
Now, the End Abortion Podcast by Priests for Life.
Friends, hello. Father Frank Pavone here, National Director of Priests for Life. Welcome to our program, and welcome to another in the series on the Dobbs case at the Supreme Court regarding abortion, the case arising out of Mississippi, Dobbs versus Jackson Women's Health Organization. There are so many briefs submitted by various pro-life organizations and experts in support of Mississippi's effort to defend its law protecting babies from 15 weeks on in pregnancy. And the court has agreed to address the question as to whether or not prohibitions on abortion prior to viability, such as Mississippi's law, are unconstitutional. Of course, the Constitution says nothing about abortion and it says nothing about viability. And so this is a very important question right now to challenge, if you will, a basic standard that the courts have been using regarding abortion laws for quite a long time. This could be a very, very significant weakening of Roe versus Wade. And if you look at what these briefs are saying, the court is being asked to overturn it altogether. There's no predicting, of course, what the Supreme Court will do at any point in time, but there is great value in understanding the arguments, and that's what our series attempts to do. And we do so by having with us so many friends, so many colleagues, so many co-warriors and laborers in this pro-life cause to discuss those arguments, and today is no exception. The Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation is a leading group in Pennsylvania when it comes to fighting abortion, and they have been friends and allies for a very long time. I have the pleasure of welcoming today both the executive director and the legislative director of that organization, Michael Chicachapo, who is the executive director, and Maria Gallagher, who serves as the legislative director. Welcome to you both.
Thank you, Father.
Thank you, Father.
So we've been together on many occasions over many years. The years are going by quickly, Michael. I remember times when, I don't know when it was, when we first started getting together, probably at the National Right to Life conventions and so forth.
But, 20 years ago, Father, 20 years ago.
20 years at least. Okay. And of course, you are an affiliate of National Right to Life, which is really the premier group when it comes to pro-life legislation and lobbying, especially at the federal level. But of course, you're taking care of Pennsylvania. Tell us a little bit more about the organization itself, Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation, which you
have. Sure. Father, the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation has been incorporated since 1979. And before that, even before Roe versus Wade, there were pro-life groups coming up all over Pennsylvania in different spots. And by 1979, they found each other. They decided to form a statewide group because they figured they could have better effect on the state as a statewide organization. And so we are actually a federation of chapters throughout the state. We have about 40 chapters throughout the state of Pennsylvania that come together as a nonprofit organization. And our mission is to announce the truth about abortion, infanticide, and euthanasia, and to fight for law and public policy that supports the right to life. And we do that as a nonprofit organization. We are a nonpartisan organization. And we are non-sectarian. We have people of all faiths who are part of the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation from all over. And we work with many, many different organizations that we collaborate with. And we were happy just recently to present your own Father Dennis Wild with a Lifetime Achievement Award here in Pennsylvania. I know he works for you, and I know he travels the world for you, but he's based here in Villanova, Pennsylvania, and we're particularly proud of him. So yes. We feel like he's part of our family, too.
Well, he is indeed, and I thank you for that honor because, you know, it's an honor given to him and by extension to Priests for Life. And, you know, I've been all throughout the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania, all throughout, every part of it. And we have a good foothold there, actually, with Priests for Life. Also, as you know, in as much as our Rachel's Vineyard team is based there as well, just yes. outside of Philadelphia. And so, and Pennsylvania, by the way, of course, as you know so well, is deeply connected with this case, because the Supreme Court is being asked to review not only Roe versus Wade, but a very significant abortion-related case that came almost 20 years later out of Pennsylvania, Planned Parenthood versus Casey. And decision, of course, reaffirmed the central holding of Roe v. Wade, but also altered things quite a bit, and is at issue very much in this case.
Well, I should tell you, Father, that the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation was the foremost organization in the writing of the Abortion Control Act in Pennsylvania in the late 1980s. And so the connection to this is that was challenged in the Supreme Court and held up all but one provision in Casey in that case. And the attorney who actually had a big role to play in writing that legislation that did so well in front of the Supreme Court is the same attorney that wrote the amicus brief in your hand. So we can talk about.
Oh, yes. Maura.
Yes.
Maura Quinlan. Yes. And I remember at the very beginning of my Priests for Life full-time work, Governor Bob Casey, meeting him, talking with him. And of course, you must have had many, many interactions with him. I mean, this was someone who represents an almost extinct breed, a pro-life Democrat in a major government position. You hardly find them anymore.
Right.
But he was a great man.
He was a great man. And we were hoping that his son would be a senator. As his father was a governor, but I'm afraid we're not finding that father.
That's right. Exactly. And Maria, now you as legislative director have had a big role in preparing this brief, I understand, together with Maura, who's the counsel of record. Let's talk a little bit about, first of all, I want to ask you both, what was the, and I think we've gotten a sense of it already from everything we've said, but what led you as an organization to decide to weigh in on this case with a friend of the court brief?
Well, I think that it was, in fact, a no-brainer because we wanted to be involved in history. We wanted to be involved in making history and overturning Roe versus Wade. And we feel that this brief is really a comfort brief to make the Supreme Court comfortable with the idea of overturning Roe. And that was the impetus for our involvement. And I think that it's the proudest achievement that I've had during my tenure as legislative director for the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation.
Let me frame the argument this way. You know, I often say in my pro-life talks, you know, the abortion industry, they want to have it both ways when it comes to the question of the legality of abortion and the safety of the procedure. And when I say they want to have it both ways, what I mean is this. They'll argue, oh, you can't outlaw abortion because then, you know, women are going to get unsafe abortions. They're going to go to back alleys. They're going to be hurt. They're going to be harmed. But then when you look at Roe versus Wade, Roe versus Wade actually made the argument that, well, now we can legalize abortion. We can get rid of these laws that prohibit it precisely because it has become safer. So they're trying to have it both ways. They're saying, well, we legalized it because it was already safe, but if we make it illegal again, it's somehow going to be unsafe. That just doesn't work. And your brief really revolves, doesn't it, around this fundamental question of whether the legalizing of abortion through Roe v. Wade had anything at all to do with making the procedure safer. Maria, can you explain the approach that you take?
The approach that we take is this, is that any improvements that have been done in terms of healthcare are the result of things like antibiotics, anesthesia, blood transfusions. It wasn't Roe versus Wade that made women safer in America. If anything, Roe versus Wade has made women less safe because abortion is inherently obviously unsafe for the child in the mother's womb, and it can also be very unsafe for the mother in terms of not only the physical effects, but the psychological impact. And what we say is that if you overturn Roe versus Wade, it is not going to negatively impact the health of women. In fact, it will improve the health of women.
Tease that out for us a little bit more, because in other words, part of what you're saying is, you know, this is, and I always point out that, you know, it's such an unnatural procedure, because yes, a medical procedure is supposed to help the body do something that it's trying to do, but it's having trouble doing. So, for example, a blockage in an artery. Well, it's trying to pump the blood through, but, you know, maybe you got to go in there and clear the blockage. So, but abortion is just the opposite. The body is doing exactly what it's supposed to do. It's doing it very well. And then you're going in there and stopping that. You're stopping the process of nurturing and protecting that baby. I compare it to, you know, driving that car down a highway 60 miles an hour and putting it in reverse. You know, you do that, you're gonna ruin the car, and maybe yourself in the process. So there are things about the dangers, the inherent dangers of abortion, that no law can take away just by saying legally, oh, it's okay to do this now. Obviously, it doesn't take away the inherent risks that you're referring to right now. And so that's, you know, obviously a big part of the argument. And it's very interesting what you say here in the brief, too, that although abortion is a medical procedure, it is rarely a medical decision. Tell us more about that.
And I love that line from Maura Quinlan, because it is so very true. We see it time and time again with women who have had abortions and who now regret them. Because the reason that a woman typically goes for an abortion is not a medical reason. I mean, that might be 1% or maybe 5% of the time. Most of the time, a woman goes for an abortion because she feels as if she has no other choice, because of a lack of support from the people around her, because of the fact that it may interfere with her schooling or may interfere with her relationships, or she may be someone who is living in poverty. Well, the fact of the matter is that abortion doesn't solve any of those problems. It is not a cure for poverty. It is not an answer to somebody's academic difficulties. It's not an answer to any of this. All it does is create more difficulties, more problems for the woman. And I think that that is so very true in our society today, that rather than looking for additional ways to perform abortions or additional access to abortion, why don't we look at the fundamental reasons why women choose abortion? And often that's because of the lack of support. And that's where pregnancy resource centers are so very important in filling that gap of support for women.
You know, connected with this, let me read one of the paragraphs here in the section that says, you know, when the other side tries to talk about maternal mortality rates in relation to abortion, the brief is saying that doesn't have any practical relevance here. And let me quote the brief. Very few women decide to have abortions because they wish to avoid risks to their physical health. And so it's disingenuous to suggest that abortion must be kept available on demand because it is statistically, quote, safer for women. This is simply not a consideration that informs their decisions, nor should it be, given the exceedingly low rate of mortality from either course of action, meaning, in other words, either bringing the child to birth or having an abortion. So, I mean, it's a brief brief, mm-hmm. but it gets to really some core medical and statistical questions here.
And I think that the genius of the brief is that it answers those arguments that are often posed by the pro-abortion forces. I mean, you hear all the time that women are going to die unless we support Roe versus Wade. Well, the fact of the matter is that it's very rare for a woman to die from abortion or from childbirth. It is certainly a tragedy when it happens. It's a terrible tragedy. But let's look at saving both the mother and the child. When a woman presents as a pregnant woman to a physician, there are two patients involved, the mother and the child. And that fact is overlooked by Roe versus Wade.
It's overlooked by Roe versus Wade, but it's certainly not overlooked by Williams Obstetrics, is it? I mean, in the key foundational medical textbook about obstetrics, it says very clearly right at the beginning, we have two patients here, the mother and the person inside the mother. Michael, going back to you, I mean, these briefs not only have legal and constitutional arguments, this is an educational treasure chest, you know, all these different briefs, this one included. And I mean, you know, you and I, you know, as we've been together in the trenches, I mean, we remember back to the days when Dr. Bernard Nathanson was going around speaking, and this is a key educational point, isn't it, that we've brought up as he brought up, that, hey, we invented the numbers of women dying from illegal abortion. I remember him putting his hands up at one of the conferences. He said, we made it up out of thin air how many women were dying from this. So this is a point, Mike, educationally, that's key to the movement, even independent of the court case, isn't it?
Absolutely. When I talked about the mission of the organization, educating the public about the truth behind abortion, infanticide, and euthanasia is a key function of our whole organization and our mission. And so in doing this brief, we not only saw the value of actually changing law and public policy, which is part of our mission, but also the educational value. First and foremost, we were thinking about educating the Supreme Court, to be honest with you. I mean,
right.
We need to make sure they understood what the truth was about abortion and what's going on with these two patients that are involved that are not even recognized, as you said, in Roe versus Wade. But as an extension then, anybody in the public who has a chance to read these briefs, as you have and many other people have, are being educated too. And we think there is some unique things about our brief like this that were very, very well done and simple that people can understand. There's two patients in every case of this, and that's what should be addressed.
You know, Roe v. Wade seemed to assert that, well, you know, America had the development of these laws that were prohibiting abortion. And they tried to make the case that it was because they wanted to protect the women from unsafe procedures. But in reality, when you look at the development of those laws and what the legislators themselves and the courts at that time were saying, it was because of an increased knowledge about the unborn child. That we were discovering more about the baby in the womb and about the way that human life comes about, and the primary intent of these laws was to protect those children, and of course protecting the women from negative consequences goes along with that. So this is great. I mean, this is it's not a long document, but it gets to, as we've been saying, some pretty key arguments. And, you know, I want to thank you for bringing it forward to the court. And, you know, right now, as we speak, they are reading through these briefs and their clerks are, you know, summarizing them and discussions are going on and arguments are being made. And we will together pray for a good outcome in this particular case. Are you finding there in Pennsylvania among the people that belong to the Federation an excitement and an awareness about the Dobbs case?
Oh, definitely. I think that people are on fire now. There is a new energy in the pro-life movement. It's palpable. You can feel it. People recognize the fact that we are on the cusp of something great, and that's the overturn of Roe versus Wade. Even if it were not to happen in the Dobbs case, eventually it will happen.
Yes.
And we feel that we're closer than ever to that day. And I have been with the Federation for 19 years. For my 20th year, I want to see Roe versus Wade tossed into the dustbin of history.
And let me ask both of you a final question in this sense. Let's say that we're just months away now, because we could be just months away from a reversal of Roe v. Wade. that the court literally just nullifies it. What happens in Pennsylvania when the court says, okay, states, you can legislate now on abortion the way you want? What would happen in Pennsylvania?
Well, one of the things we're already anticipating that, Father, because we've formed a coalition already here in Pennsylvania to work on a Pennsylvania amendment to our Constitution that would say that abortion, number one, should not be paid for with taxpayer funds. That's already been ruled on by our state Supreme Court, and it's being challenged now by pro-abortion attorneys. They're challenging in the state Supreme Court, which unfortunately has gone a little lopsided on the liberal side. But they're also arguing that there should be a fundamental right to abortion in Pennsylvania, enshrined in the Pennsylvania Constitution. So we really are trying to get at the front of that whole thing so that we're prepared with a constitutional amendment ourselves, which would say that, no, there is no right to taxpayer funding of abortion in the Pennsylvania Constitution, because there isn't. And there is no fundamental right to abortion in the Pennsylvania Constitution. And we can get that through two sessions of our very pro-life General Assembly. We have a very pro-abortion governor, but the governor doesn't play a role in that process. And then the big battle is going to be when it goes to the ballot. Once it gets through two sessions of the General Assembly, it has to go to the voters. And that's when we're going to have to win over the majority of Pennsylvanians to get that amendment put into the Constitution so that we don't have to worry about it anymore.
Right, exactly. Well, you know, sometimes people say that once Roe v. Wade throws this back to the states, you know, then the battle is going to begin in the states. But it's not that way. It's not that the battle is going to begin in the states, because as the two of you exemplify, as the Pennsylvania Pro-Life Federation itself exemplifies, the battle in the states has been fully engaged for a very long time. The courts have been trying to put a cap on how far the states can go. But of course, that's exactly what's at issue in this case. But the battle is engaged. The work is being done. The ground troops are there. And we thank you for all that work that's been done on all these years in Pennsylvania. It's had an impact, of course, on the whole nation. And my goodness, it'll be an even greater impact in the years to come. So it's a joy working with you and your team. And I thank you also for shedding light on this important brief to the court.
Thank you for having us, Father. Yes.
My pleasure. And thank you, friends, for joining us for this episode. Please go to SupremeCourtVictory.com. That's our special website for more of these interviews, for the documents themselves. You can read through all the pro-life briefs, and for the prayer campaign for victory in this case. Go to SupremeCourtVictory.com, and we'll keep you informed as this case develops. God bless you all. And on behalf of Priests for Life, this is Father Frank Pavone, National Director. We will talk to you soon.
This has been the End Abortion Podcast. To learn more, to help end abortion, and to connect with us on social media, visit endabortion.net.